So what I say is the number one job of an entrepreneur is not to do the job, but to be a creator of jobs. And if you and I are doing the work, we're effectively stealing it from someone who wants to do the work. We have to be the ones who are empowering others to live a good life. So if someone's making a business grow, yet the business owner is still needed for every aspect of the business, that's not just unhealthy for the entrepreneur, it's unhealthy for our economy. We need to be the creators of jobs, not doers of jobs.
Welcome to the Growth Mixtape Podcast, and I'm your host, Bob Mathers. Each episode, I talk to ordinary people doing extraordinary things. We hear their stories and how they've overcome the same shitty fears we all face to live a bigger life. And if they can do it, so can we. Today, we talk to Mike Michalowicz, best-selling author of Profit First, a revolutionary system implemented by over a million companies around the world to make profit a habit, not a year-end event. As Mike puts it, the entrepreneurial dream of working for yourself, working as much or as little as you want, having complete freedom, it's a myth for most people. Most business owners I know are stressed out, working their asses off, and barely getting by. And that was Mike too, so he decided to start writing about it. And that was 10 books ago. So I've got a confession to make. This episode was a bit of a test, a bit of a challenge to myself. I was curious, can I make a conversation about finance interesting? What could we possibly say that hasn't been said? Well, if you know Mike, you know I had nothing to worry about. This was one of the most fun conversations I've ever had. Mike's got a story for everything, including the financial rock bottom that inspired his new book, The Money Habit. Now, I've never been great with money, and I know I've left a lot of it on the table over the years. And as I near what most people call retirement, that's starting to concern me more than it used to. But honestly, I also feel like I'm just getting started. So sure, I could have used this conversation 20 years ago, but it's also just what I need right now. If you're struggling to make your business work for you, or maybe you just want to hear about how someone writes 10 best-selling books about something no one wants to talk about, this one's for you. Please enjoy Mike Michalowicz. Mike, welcome to the show. I've been looking forward to this for a long time.
Oh, me too. And a little part of me wants to pull out the guitars at the end. I'm probably out of tune, but jam out for a little bit.
Yeah, that's a good idea. You know, the where this conversation came from is interesting. We have a mutual friend, Peter Laughter, who I had on last year. He reached out. He said, hey, I got a friend of mine, Mike. He's writing a new book. I think he'd be a great guest. I was like, okay, any friend of Peter's is a friend of mine. You and I chatted. You couldn't have been more gracious. We agreed to set this up, and here we are. Yeah. But then, of course, after that, I had done some research and I was like, holy shit, this guy's a big deal. Like, this isn't friend of Peter that's decided to try writing a book. This is his 10th book.
Yeah.
He's had some huge books. And all of a sudden, I'm a little bit intimidated. I'm like, you know, if I had known Mike was such a big deal, I probably would have been a little nervous about reaching out to him. But anyway, it's funny how things work out that way.
Yeah. Thank you for that. I don't know about the big deal part, but thank you. You know, I was listening to your podcast. Loved the interview with Jessica Finkelstein.
Yes.
I was out for a run just listening to that. First of all, thank you because you gave me one of the best runs of my life. I went an extra 2 miles because I couldn't finish listening. It was like so good. And I'm like, oh, just keep going. So an extra almost 20 minutes of runtime because of you.
Jessie is amazing. Yeah, she was on the show last year as well. That's awesome.
It was just so human, you know. Wildly successful entrepreneur, it was just so human. Both of you.
Well, I appreciate that. And I think that's something that really, you know, that I loved about that conversation with her too. She was very much like that. Like, I don't remember how we got introduced, but when we chatted, it was like, oh yeah, wow. Yeah. Massive deal. So it's funny how you stumble across these people in your lives.
Yeah.
So I want to get into your new book, and I've got obviously a ton of questions. You know, you've started a bunch of companies. You've sold some, you're still running a few of them. You've written 10 books. You travel the world speaking to leaders. So much of it comes down to like challenging some of the basics and fundamentals of how we've always thought about running our business or our finances. And there's a real passion behind this stuff and the themes that run through your book that I got to believe can only come from some sort of personal experience or maybe even trauma. So what, like, where does your passion for this kind of stuff come from?
That's a good point. Yeah, we learned through the burn, I guess. And Yeah. So I've been an entrepreneur my entire life, but not a good one. And I still question my abilities today. And that's why I keep writing. So I remember I was at a speaking engagement at a university, and this was early on in my author career. So this goes back almost 15 years ago. And I'm with my buddy who came along the ride, and we're walking to like the auditorium where the students and professors were actually coming too. And we walk by a classroom that's in session, and he kind of points in and he goes, "Oh, there's the best student." And I didn't pay any mind to it. And we keep walking, and next room, "There's the best student." And you know, my head's in preparing for the speech, but by the third one, I'm like, "Dude, wait, what's this best student thing?" He's like, "Do you know how to pick out the best student in every classroom? It's so obvious." So I'm like, okay, I'm falling for this trap. I'm like, "It's the kid up front." He goes, "Nope." Like, "It's the one taking the most notes." He goes, "Nope." "Most questions? Surely it's them." "Nope." He goes, "It's the teacher, Mike. The best student is always the teacher, because when you teach it, you have to achieve the highest level of proficiency, curiosity, and so forth." And I was like, oh my gosh, that became a foundational understanding for me. So every book I've written, the 10 books, and I, you know, this next one coming out, it's always been because I really don't understand the topic to the level I need to be as capable as I need to be as an entrepreneur.
Yeah, interesting. One of the things that I think you say is that I eradicate entrepreneurial poverty. I'm like, oh my God, that guy is speaking right to my soul. Where did that come from?
Yeah. So let's define what it is. So entrepreneurial poverty is this vision of success. And sadly, it's a vision of grandeur for many people. It's economic, financial success. It's personal freedom. Do what I want when I want. It's impact, serving community. And then the reality of I'm not making a dime. I'm working my tail off. I'm exhausted. And impact, forget it. I can't put food on the table. This gap is what I call entrepreneurial poverty. But the most perverse part is you and I, Bob, we got to put out this false sense of success. Otherwise, we compromise our ability to serve. So the analogy I use is like a doctor. Imagine like one of us was rushing to the hospital and the doctor comes out and she says, "I'm really not doing well at all. Financially, I'm struggling. I work my ass off. I'm just exhausted. And I don't even know how I'm going to pay for my dinner tonight for my family. You ready for the procedure?" Like, no, F no. Like, don't touch me. And the funny thing is, entrepreneurs, we're not saving lives necessarily, but we're altering them. We're doing something substantial in someone's life in some capacity. So we can't say necessarily our truth. And then this becomes this perverse recurring pattern of fake it until you never make it. So I'm on a mission to fix that because I lived that life way too long. And the irony too, Bob, I thought if I just got to a certain threshold, $1 million in revenue, or maybe it's 10 or whatever the number was, that the fix would happen, that there would be this switch that flips. And it never did. I had a $7 million business and I was dying. I didn't know how to handle the payroll, which was over six figures a week. And I was so terrified. It was the worst I ever experienced. So this eradicating entrepreneurial poverty is not just for a brand new startup. It's any size business. We need to get it fixed. And that's the greatest way we can be of impact. If you're healthy, if you're financially sound, if you're not pulled every which way in your business and can concentrate on what you enjoy and do best, you can be of the greatest service. So what I say is the number one job of an entrepreneur is not to do the job, but to be a creator of jobs. And if you and I are doing the work, we're effectively stealing it from someone who wants to do the work. We have to be the ones who are empowering others to live a good life. So if someone's making a business grow, yet the business owner is still needed for every aspect of the business, that's not just unhealthy for the entrepreneur, it's unhealthy for our economy. We need to be the creators of jobs, not doers of jobs.
Yeah, interesting. The creator of jobs, not the doer of jobs. So I wanted to talk about, I mean, like I said, you've written 10 books, so we're not going to get into all of them. I wanted to talk about Profit First, which is one that was maybe your third or fourth, maybe your fifth book. It's the one I think you're best known for. What was it about that book that seemed to take off in a way that others hadn't yet? Because it reminds me of, you ask like Robert De Niro or Keith Richards, you know, when they're halfway through a movie, or Keith Richards is halfway writing through Satisfaction, you know, "Did you know this was going to be the biggest song of your career?" It's like, "No, I had no idea. I wrote five other songs that day. That's just the one that people seem to grab onto. Did you ever have that? Can you resonate with that, or does that resonate with you at all?
Yeah, you know, there's a couple of inklings it would go, but every one of the books I wrote, I'm like, this is the best of me at that moment. But I will tell you the common approach I use for every one of my books. I call it the Dumbo model. And it's D stands for desire. U stands for understanding. But D for desire, M for method. And then the last part, O, is for outcome. Small B stands for beliefs. So it does spell Dumbo, but D-M-O. So I'll interview an entrepreneur and say, what's your desire in regards to income, we'll say. And they say, you know, I want to be financially free. I don't ever want to worry about bills. Okay, that's our desire. What's the method you follow? Well, when sales comes into our organization, we pay our expenses and leftovers profit. I said, okay, what's the actual outcome? Well, there's no profit. So when the desire is financial freedom and the outcome is nothing, I look in the center, which is the method, and say, oh, the model's not right. So it sounds absurd, but I was looking at it and saying sales minus expenses equals profits not working. Why wouldn't that work? I mean, everyone does it. And then it hit me like a ton of bricks. I was like, holy cannoli. Profit is last. It's human nature. When something comes last, it means it's insignificant. So you never say, you know, I love my family, I'm putting them last now, or my health matters, therefore it's going to come last. It comes first. So I said, okay, when priority's first, how do you do that in the formula? It was real obvious. Sales minus profit equals expenses. So in practice, with profit first, every time revenue comes in as a deposit into the organization, we take a predetermined percentage as profit, hide it from the business, and then you run the business off the remainder. So it's the pay yourself first principle, just as a business application of it.
Yeah, and also expenses in this case will take up as much room as we give it.
That's right.
Right? So if that expenses comes last, then we'll figure out a way to run the business on whatever's left between whatever's left from the revenue after we take our profit out of it.
Human nature. Yeah. And that all my books are rooted in behavioral psychology. I'm not a behavioral psychologist. It's just fascinating to me kind of how our noggins work. And so to your point, there's a theorem called Parkinson's Law. It was originally studied around time. So there's this guy, Northcote Parkinson, who notices that the more time we're given to complete a task, the longer it takes to complete a task, which is not logical, but it's very human. What the theorem came is that as a resource expands in availability, the more we have of something, the more we consume it. The fuller my toothpaste tube, I'll use more. When your toothpaste tube is empty, you use it in small drips and drabs. Well, money is the same way. As more money flows into a business, the more the owner consumes it. And that's why we have this frustration. It seems almost uncanny. It's like, finally, I had my breakthrough month. Most money ever flowing to my business. And then the next day, we're like, where the hell did it all go? Where it all went was the behavior of consumption. We see a resource, money, and we say, oh, now I can afford that computer. Oh, I can make that higher now. And we deplete it. So what Profit First does, it's similar to like a 401k, which at least in the US has been the greatest savings mechanism in history, actually, for people, is before you get your net pay, the 401k, your retirement savings are pulled out of your gross income. In your business, before the business gets a dime to spend, your profit is stored and hidden away, assuring that profitability.
Well, there's a couple of things about that. You know, as entrepreneurs, we start off with this vision of financial freedom and I'm my own boss and I can take vacation whenever I want. And you ask 99 out of 100 entrepreneurs, that is not how they would describe their life. It's like you described it. It's just freaking stressed out and miserable and like marriage falling apart. I can't, you know. And so it's like, wait a minute. Like, it's of course that's going to happen when we're not thoughtful about it, like you were proposing in Profit First. It's really interesting.
Yeah, we're in such a reactionary mode. And I do this little chart, but basically I'll take the letter A and put a circle around it and say, this is point A, put in the middle of a piece of paper. And I'll say, if you're in crisis right now, what is the fastest way out of A? Draw an arrow in that direction. And the answer is any direction. Any direction that gets you away from A serves you, so you can go up, down, left, right, diagonal. Then I say, okay, let's now put a B in the bottom left corner of that piece of paper and put a circle around it. And if you drew an arrow getting out of crisis, how many folks in this room or whatever has an arrow pointing toward B? B being the healthy move for the business. And almost no arrows because the reason is obvious, because we didn't know where B was going to be. So what I explain in that illustration is we have to have clarity on what a healthy business is. And then we have to make decisions that are consistent with it. Well, how do you get clarity on that? Is by taking your profit first. That's the financial health, and there's other elements of health. But when you take your financial health, we've now secured it. Now, because that's been secured, we've identified we're building profit. That's the B. Now, what decisions can I make that will support that? Well, I can't buy that equipment because the money has been taken out already. What I can do, and this is actually a case study we did here. We do the profit first method, of course. And our team came together and we said, we need to upgrade our computer equipment, including this computer. And we said, we have a CapEx count for capital equipment. We said, we barely have enough funds to buy the new computers. Plus we want to reserve that for other things because we've taken our profit first. Now a weaker heart of mine would say, well, just take our profit and let's buy equipment. But what we did is we said, well, what alternatively can we do? Well, we're in New Jersey and this is like the pharmaceutical capital of the world, at least where we are. So we called some of these large pharmas, including La Roche, and we called them, spoke to the HR department and said, hey, we're a small local business. We don't have computers, but we assume you churn your computers every so often. If you're going to discard of anything, we'd love it. And they said, yeah. They go, ironically, a month ago, we started our employee buy program where our old computers, and for them, old was 2 years old. Our computers are 2 years old and our employees can buy them for $50. We have 600 left right now. You're willing to take them for free, get them off our hands. Well, we don't have a big enough office for 600, but we have enough for 16. So we took 16 of those computers. This computer is faster than anything I could have ever afforded to buy, and it costs nothing. But I'll tell you, I would have never thought of that, Bob, if I had money available. Parkinson's law would say, grab that resource, spend it. But since I don't, necessity becomes a mother of invention, and you find an alternative path, which ironically sometimes can be better than the natural path of spending money.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And so you actually propose different, like almost a simple system of bank accounts, like a dollar of revenue comes in and X percentage of profit goes out to this special bank account. And that's your pool over there, and maybe one for taxes. And so, because I think the way that most of us work it is, well, we have a bank account, you know, the revenue comes in there, the expenses come out of there. At the end of the year, we do the math and see how much money we made. And it reminds me a bit of, like, you know, the James Clear thing, like where, you know, like this system is put in place so we don't have to rely on motivation and discipline. It's a system that we do once and then the business runs itself.
Yeah. So I can't remember who it was, but someone said automation is the new discipline. Mm. When it happens on automatic, it just happens. In regards to the bank accounts, you nailed it. And it is another behavioral technique. Your accounting system, whatever it is a far superior resource to make those type of decisions, because it can allocate where money has been spent, where it should go. You can do budget and forecasting, all these wonderful things. So the question, of course, is if it's so powerful, why doesn't everyone have a very profitable business? Because no one looks at their accounting. I don't. I log in my bank account because it is the path of water. It's the path of least resistance. I check my bank account, I think 2 or 3 times today already, just to see if that deposit came in. How are we doing? So if that's our natural path, we have to set up what I call a behavioral intercept. And a good analogy for this is with exercise. This is back 15, 20 years ago. I played sports in college, and after college was over, I'm like, I'm never going to move again. Well, that didn't work so well, and I wasn't looking so good. And I said, I better get back in shape. So the first reaction was, I'm going to do this out of discipline. I'm not going to miss a workout. I'm all in on this. The next morning I woke up, I was all fired up, got a great workout in. The next day I was sore and said, maybe this is the day to take off. And it fell apart within a week. So I said, okay, what am I doing naturally where I can insert like a James Clear intercept or system to ensure I get done? And I noticed, Bob, I'd wake up in the morning, go to the bathroom, make a cup of coffee, scroll through the news, and then I lose another day of exercise. But in that consistent pattern of wake up bathroom, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to take my sneakers and put them on the toilet seat, which I still do to date. And when I wake up in the morning, the only way I can use the toilet is by grabbing the sneakers. Once the sneakers are in my hand, momentum kicks in, like just put on my feet and go to the gym, walk down to the gym. And sure enough, I work out 5 days a week, religiously, because I can't avoid it. And that's what we do with the bank account. We're going to set multiple accounts at your bank because I know that's where you're going. That's the toilet seat. And when you go there, we're going to see accounts with its pre-intended purposes there. So money flows in instead of one account, which it comes into, we're going to then carve it up automatically on a percentage basis to these different accounts. So you have one to pay for your taxes, one to make sure you're getting a salary for yourself, profitability, of course, one for your capital expenditures, one for your ongoing operations. And in most businesses, we start off with 5 accounts, but a business that rolls this out over time could have 10, sometimes 15. We have 20 accounts, and that's like profit first on steroids and unnecessary for almost all businesses. But more accounts give more clarity.
Yeah, interesting. And that shoes on the toilet resonates too. I've never thought about how to apply that, some of that psychology to my business though, but I do think about it all the time. Like, oh shit, I do not want to run. And I, you know, just get up and do your stretching. And then once you get your shoes on, well, you know what? I'll just go for a short run. And then you get outside and you're like, well, you're running. It's like, well, why would I go for a short run? I've done the hardest part. Like, I've already done all the, you know, I've gotten through the mental hurdles. So I might as well go a little further.
It's the absolute truth. The momentum, you throw in a couple extra kilometers. And, you know, the shame is with profit for businesses, most of them don't do it. And therefore they wait till the end of the year and there's no profit. And there's this big deflating moment. It's like, gosh, when is it ever going to happen? So what I say is profit is not an event, as in it's not an eventuality. Profit's not an event. Profit is a habit. But as the weeks and months and ultimately quarters and years go by, it's unbelievable how much money you will save and store for profit. Because the beauty of the system is too, is when profit gets into the account, we don't necessarily distribute all of it. We usually distribute 50% of the accumulated funds. And so not only do we take a profit distribution in that moment, we also know next quarter we're halfway to our goal or beyond. You know, we can grow that even further. And it's just a wonderful feeling that every single quarter you have a profit-making machine.
Hey, it's Bob, and I'm taking the Growth Mixtape on the road in a series of keynote speeches inspired by the stories of my amazing guests. At their core, these signature talks are about how to get you and your teams off autopilot and stop settling for small incremental improvements. This isn't going to come from spewing business advice. My podcast is full of people that have done incredible things, and every one of them struggles with self-doubt, imposter syndrome, and the crippling fear of judgment that holds so many of us back. They've also found ways through it by rediscovering their creativity, their curiosity, and the confidence to do scary things. Imagine the power of bringing these vulnerable stories to life, live and on stage, to help you and your teams hit your targets, find your voice, and be the rock stars you are. Book me for your next event at bobmathers.ca. Now back to the show. Okay, so then the book, your 10th book, The Money Habit, it's 10th, right?
That is number 10, actually. Yeah, The Money Habit, yeah.
So maybe you hinted at this earlier, but how do you come up with something new and interesting to say that still got all the passion and all the passion behind it as your first book? And where does that story come from? Where does The Money Habit come from?
Yeah, there's two elements. I was just telling you before we went on air, I was at this author's meetup that I facilitate. And there was a guy named Joseph Wynn. He wrote a book called Don't Believe Everything You Think. Just the nicest, most unassuming guy who has a book that is crushing it. And as opposed to the other authors, he said, I write books, and we all should write books, because it serves an internal challenge that we have so deeply. It fixes it so well for ourselves. He goes, write the book first to serve yourself. Secondly, when you do write it, before you write, you got to make sure that there's a community that thirsts for this. So you're actually serving yourself as you serve others. And when you're helping serve yourself, I think there's a higher level of curiosity and desire. So The Money Habit, how it came about, it was like, well, in my business, I first deployed profit first and it was great. And my business was getting more and more profitable. But then I noticed my lifestyle started to expand. All of a sudden, I need that fancier car, man. Like, you know, everything starts going up with it. And I was still living check by check at home. I'm like, this is crazy. With such a healthy business, I still live check by check. I'm like, oh yeah, idiot. You got to do this at home too. So I deployed the system for myself. Now, if I did profit first, say 17, 18 years ago, this would have been like a year later. And it transformed the relationship I had with my wife. Prior, when it came to finances, I'm the person who handles finances at our house. Usually there's one person in the household that's the primary financial person. That was me. And we had this kind of like parent-child relationship. Like my wife would say, hey, I want to go out with my friends for lunch. May I? And I'd be like, not this time, not enough money. Or I'd say, okay, here's your lollipop. And there's this unspoken, almost animosity. Her, because there's a frustration, she's got to ask permission and I have this authority over her. Me, for her being so thoughtless to think about going out with friends when we need the money. And so there's this conflict. So 17 years ago, or whatever it was, we implemented this profit first system, but translated to home finances. And all of a sudden, it was no longer parent-child. We were both observers of a system. And it follows the exact same script. There's multiple accounts at the bank. And as recently as just yesterday, my wife texted me. He goes, I was saying we should go out to dinner. And we have an account that says, go out to dinner. And there's like this favorite restaurant we have. I'm like, oh, we should head out to our favorite place. And she texts back and says, hey, why don't we wait a week? The account's a little low. It's beautiful. There's no longer me telling her or her telling me. There's no conflict. It's the system and how do we work it together as a team? So that's why I needed it. Then I started hearing from entrepreneurs, which was fascinating, having the same problem for themselves. I'm like, okay, so you need it. But the bigger thing was an entrepreneur called me and say, I have 15 employees. I have 100 employees. I have 2 employees, whatever it is. They were all saying the same thing. My colleagues that work with me are often coming to me saying, I need a raise or a loan or something. There was some financial struggle. And I want to accommodate it, but I'm burying my business in this process. I can't do it. And if I can't do it, they're going to leave me. So how do I help people that need more money and not lose them because I can't afford to give them more? And the answer was, none of us need more money first. We first need more clarity. And so I'm like, we got to teach our colleagues, our employees, financial understanding to give them something that they can wrap their hands around. It's super simple. To give them financial clarity, which then brings about control. With financial control comes financial independence. Then as more money flows in, they have much more authority over it. So the money habit was clear. Entrepreneurs needed it, but so did our teams.
Yeah. For, regular listeners to the podcast, I quote Rick Rubin a lot. And he wrote a book a couple of years ago called The Creative Act. And he talks about what you were talking about as well, Mike. You've got to create for yourself.
Yeah. And there's this little magic in there too. I sat at this author's retreat just because it happened so recently. I think there's some relevant stuff. I actually shared a home with Michael Bungay Stanier. He's the author of The Coaching Habit. He's gone on to sell millions and millions of copies. One of the nicest dudes on the planet, by the way. And, whenever I do a trip, if there's other authors in the area, I'm the guy who's like, hey, I'll get the place if we can all stay together because I can pick these people's minds. So it's like 6 in the morning. Michael's eating breakfast and I walk over to him like, hey, I got to ask you a question. How do you sell a lot of books? Because he sold so many. And he used a curse word. I'll take that out. He goes, hell if I know. Well, that's still a curse word, but hell if I know, basically he said. And then we're meeting up with 50 other authors later that morning. He goes, they don't know either. He goes, the only thing I can tell you that determines a hit, the Hotel California equivalent, is if you've lived it, he goes, there's that 1% of extra stuff that makes it into the book because you've been through it. Maybe it's relatability, maybe it's technique, maybe it's all the above. But he said that's the only thing he can attribute a blockbuster book to versus a great book that never sees much of the light of day.
Yeah. I love that. You share a lot of some pretty heartbreaking stories in the book from your life and from the lives of other people that have shared them with you. Is there one story that you never get tired of telling, even if it's hard to tell?
Yeah. I mean, I have my own stories. I don't get tired of telling it. It's when I hit financial rock bottom. But this is a little spin on that. I rarely tell. I think I did put in this book, built some businesses, had no financial acuity whatsoever, didn't have any system, was spending money frivolously and thinking I'd grow my way to a lifestyle. And that's never the case. And I remember I had hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt. I want to say it was like over $300,000 of debt, credit card debt, an SBA loan, which I personally guaranteed, all these different things. And I had no income coming in. It was the rock bottom moment. I'm driving in my car, and on the radio, there's like one of these debt consolidators, you know, like whatever, we'll get you out of debt type of thing, which is super interesting. When I have that stress on me, like I'll actually listen to that stuff and want to believe it. I was getting stuff in the mail saying like, you know, lick envelopes or whatever and make $1,000 a day. And I'm like, more financially sound means like that's a scam. But in desperation, I'm willing to believe desperate things. I'm like, well, maybe I'll lick envelopes. Sure, I can do this. Total nonsense. But on the radio comes one of these debt consolidators and they say, the average American has $7,000 of debt. And these tears start welling up and I'm streaming. I had to pull the car over and snot bubbles snapping. I'm like, I want to be average. Oh God, I want to be average so badly. But that's not my favorite story. Just one other story comes to mind. There was a guy, Sam Horton, I put in the book. This dude had the ultimate courage. Married, his spouse dies. When his spouse died, they left him hundreds of thousands of dollars. They had a terminal disease and they wanted to make sure that Sam was taken care of. And he squandered it just because he didn't have, not because he wanted to, he just had no financial security. So he just blew it all. And the shame, we had our first call. So before I write a book, I will work with people through this. And the shame he had around this. He's like, I squandered it all. I've ruined it. And this is never what my spouse wanted for me. And the courage he had, he's like, you have to share this story. He's like, because I'm not alone. Like there's so many people go through this. And he goes, I'm at rock bottom in this moment, and I don't even know if I can get out of here, but I'm willing to start using the system. That story just rocked me. It was actually a very hard one to write because I just felt so bad for this. It's a good person who's struggling in a bad way.
Yeah. And when I was, so you provided me an early version of the book, and yeah, it's, so I've got I graduated in economics. I wouldn't say I've been particularly smart with my money. And at 55, I look back and be like, yeah, I could be crippled with kind of the regret of knowing that I, you know, probably left a couple million on the table by not being smarter over the last 30 years. But on the other hand, I also believe, and I think a lot of people I talk to believe, that I probably have another career or two still in me. Mm. So the greater tragedy would be looking back when I'm 80 or 85 and looking back at this moment and saying, well, it was too late. Like I was 55, right? Like I can, so I guess that's a long-winded way of saying, yeah, what advice do you have for people that might think that this book was written for them 30 years ago?
Yeah. Well, it was, and it's right? Still applicable now. Right. So it's the old, when do you plant the tree? Proverb, best time, I should say, 40 years ago, second best time is today. Wherever we are in our financial progress, wherever our struggles are, the best time to have started was then, but then's gone.
Yeah.
The second chance is now. I'll show you something I got here. I actually rarely show this, but this is I use an AI app. That's supposedly me. So what I'm holding up is a aged picture of me. When I turn 85, that's, by the way, if I look like that at 85 with a full head of hair, you know, like Santa Claus, I look amazing. I will take that all day long. There's no way I'm going to look like that. But I look at that picture every morning. It sits here on the side of this desk. And I say, is he grateful for what I did today? It's a great conversation to have. Mm. So and you just had it. You said, well, my 80th, am I going to look back? It's funny that the financial progress we'll make in the moment will be drips in a bucket. And it feels like there's nothing. But fast forward a few years from now, it's like, oh, there's a little something. And then I explore investing at a very surface level. This book's not about investing. It's about cash discipline, which I think is fundamental to money management. You fast forward 5 years from now, and the analogy I put in the book is that you can take money and store some under your mattress, or you can put in some kind of compound interest bearing thing. In the very beginning, they run it parallel, but slowly over time, the compounding starts exploding. And 20 years from today, it will become unbelievable of how much money you've saved and how much that money's worked for you in interest bearing opportunities that it becomes transformative. And gosh, if we can get 30 years and you're still talking 30 years, whew, that's a game changer. And maybe, you know, with AI and stuff like this, maybe it's actually a 40-year trajectory, which isn't unrealistic anymore. And it can provide you a life of theoretically infinite returns. So that's my loquacious answer to say, today's the day to start. It's never too late. Yes, it could have been earlier, but it's never too late.
Yeah. Yeah, that's amazing. My son just like today signed the offer for his first job at a college, right? So he's got a salary. Oh yeah, it's amazing.
Mazel tov.
And man, this conversation couldn't have happened at a better time. It's just like, okay, here, let's get into this book. Let's set up some bank accounts and you know what? You're never going to miss that. You know, you're never going to miss 5 to 10% of that money that's coming in every 2 weeks. You're never going to see it. You're never going to miss it. And you've got this sort of, you know, this version of your AI old man there. It's like, yeah, guy is going to be sitting on a shit ton of cash.
Yeah. It's a beautiful thing. So congratulations to your son. My son started his first career job now about 8 months ago. And one thing we've done with all of our children, we're similar age and my kids are, my youngest is 24, but we sat down with all our children and said, when you get a job and you're building an income stream, we're going to set up multiple accounts at the bank for different things, including an automobile account. And your first car, you're going to buy it for cash. And it ain't going to be a great car, but you're going to buy it for cash. But when you own that car, you're going to continue to make car payments on a car that you own outright for the next car. So each of my children, now I don't have access to their finances, so they report to me, and I hope they're not lying to me and themselves, have an automobile account. And so my youngest son is, I think he's hocking away $400 a month as his car payment, but it's going to himself, which is also compounding. And the car he bought, the life trajectory on a used car of that type, maybe 7 years if you really push it, but likely 5 years. And 5 years at $400 a month is $5,000 roughly. That's $25,000 plus interest. That's a substantial down payment on a new car, but you can also buy a used car in today's dollars for that. And then maybe next time he does $700, or maybe halfway in through this, he moves at $400 to $500 or $600. But you stay in that discipline. And now you're in front of debt, which is amazing. I aspire none of my children to have debt, except for some asset-based debt, like a mortgage or something. I think that's prudent use of funds. But otherwise, I want them to be in front of cash, in front of the debt. I think what's also interesting that isn't often discussed around money is the psychology. I can't tell you how many people come to work, because I'm in the entrepreneurial space, as employees or the owner, and they're struggling financially, and therefore they actually can't work as well. There's this, I have what's called tinnitus, which is a ringing in the ears, a birth defect, but I always hear ringing. I always felt financial worry, and it is distracting. Like, how am I going to pay for the mortgage this week or this month? How am I going to pay for the groceries? And if that's going on, we can't be our best selves. And I don't want my children to be in that spot. I don't want anyone to be in that spot. And I think this is the way out of it.
Man, I could talk about this forever, Mike. This has been just, God, I love this. If there's one thing you want people to take away from the money habit, what is it?
It's at your bank. And it doesn't matter what bank you do this at, but whatever bank you use and log into, set up one account today. And actually, the whole system, you can set up 6 accounts and you can do all these things, and it is amazing, but I'm afraid of overwhelm. So it's a 2-step process that I promise you will transform your finances and start giving you more authority over it than ever before. And maybe over time you roll it out. So step one is at your current bank, step one, additional savings or checking account, but give it a name that is specific to your biggest financial concern. So if I am concerned most often about paying the mortgage every month, call it mortgage. If my biggest financial concern is groceries every week, call it groceries. If my biggest financial concern is, can we go on vacation this year? Call vacation. So whatever that biggest concern is. Step two is allocate the money necessary on that periodic basis to cover that mortgage or the groceries or that vacation. But just pick the one thing. So let's just say, I'm just picking a random number. My mortgage is $3,000 a month. I don't know. Could be anything. But I got to allocate every week the equivalent of $3,000. So was that $750 or $800, whatever, maybe a little bit more than that. But every week for that month, it's going in there. Now what I've done is I've assured with 100% positivity, the mortgage is covered, which will alleviate that worry. The other thing will happen is that there's less money available for the other things, which now forces you to get into a dynamic budgeting situation. Oh, I can't go out to dinner every night or whatever it is. I can't spend things here because the mortgage needs to be covered. So it starts bringing this clarity. When all the money's gummed in one account, we have financial confusion. It's like, oh, there's a lot of money in there. Why not go out to dinner again? But when I assured the biggest worry is addressed, then you see what's available for the rest. And that will start getting you into this dynamic, real-time cash management at your bank level.
Yeah. And the peace of mind that would come from knowing that, yeah, your biggest mm-hmm. financial worry is sort of taken care of.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I love that. Man, this has been so good, Mike. Okay, a closing question, which I also stole from Tim Ferriss. If you had a billboard and you could write on it anything you wanted, you could put a picture, a meme, a saying, and a million people would see it every day, what would you put on it?
Well, maybe I'd put, I love you, Tim Ferriss, because I am a big fan. Maybe you'd see it. I think I would put, probably put let's eradicate entrepreneurial poverty. Just back to, it's so purposeful for me. Mm-hmm. You know, you asked early on, you said sometimes it's trauma-based or transformational-based. So I went through my version, and trauma is such an abused word, so I gotta be very careful, but it was financial trauma. It was a traumatic period, and it left this indelible mark on me. Here's the truth, I think, for all humanity. What we teach, honestly, is what we need to learn. Mm-hmm. What we're trying to fix, it's actually something we're trying to fix inside. I'm not good with money. I'm really good now, but I wasn't. I still have the propensity to be really bad with money. Like I could mess it up again. So I need this. And so I teach it because I need it. And there's all these entrepreneurial components that I think need to be fixed. So that's why I think that mission of eradicating entrepreneurial poverty would be up there.
Yeah. And as you're saying that, there's a lot of truth in that. You know, personally too, about, yeah, I think the work that I do is in part to kind of heal old wounds or help people with things that I've often struggled with. And I know that that resonates with a lot of people. Man, this has been so great. Damn, Mike, I honestly wish we had,
it's been fun.
I wish we had another hour. I can't thank you enough for this. So when does the new book come out?
January 27th, it'll be all bookstores. So Powell's, Barnes and Noble's, Amazon, if that's your go-to thing, internationally available. It's already been in translation mode. So some publishers internationally for Spanish and French have reached out already. So those will be out a few months later, but January 27th is the big day. It is available for pre-order. So I'm encouraging people to pick it up now.
Yeah, it's going to be absolutely on my recommended reading list.
Thanks,
as
brother.
Is Profit First now with all the founders and entrepreneurs I work with. This has been amazing. I can't thank you enough, Mike.
Likewise, Bob. Thank you.
The Growth Mixtape Podcast with Bob Mathers is produced by Bespoke Projects. Music by Je M'appelle Walter Cronkite. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to follow and rate us. When you do this, it helps to raise our podcast profile so that more people can find us. If you want to connect, you can find me on LinkedIn using the link in the show notes.